Good evening, everyone. Feels strange to say that I'm excited to have a conversation with you about difficult conversations, but the truth is that I am. And I want to offer just a quick disclaimer, as is traditional, before we get into the sources. And that is, what I'm actually going to try to do is probably disappoint you, in that I'm sure many of you are hoping that I will give you the tools to say the right thing, when actually what we are going to be doing is try to reframe some of these conversations as being actually not about trying to say the right thing. I think particularly we often get caught in thinking that if we just find the exact right way to put things, that will kind of resolve certain difficulties. I find that to be not true. And so in tonight's lecture and in the other two lectures in the series, which I hope you will join us for, we are going to be taking a little bit of a backwards route into having these conversations, not really focusing on the actual content of what you say, but more on the questions of whether you should say, what you might do instead of speaking, which is particularly a really significant component of what it means to come from mourners, as we're going to see in the text as we proceed, where there is actually a very significant emphasis on silence, right? Where really, when we come to pay a shiva call, we're not going there to say certain words, either the formula that many of us have learned to say, may the omnipresent comfort you among the mourners, et cetera, or our own, you know, special spin. I'm so sorry for your loss, your father, your mother, et cetera, was such an XYZ person, right? All of those kinds of statements, we're gonna try to put them aside and really focus on other ways to be comforting and to be present for mourners. But we're gonna start with tshuva, with a responsum of Rav Moshe. It is clear that the mitzvah to comfort mourners is not only that they bless him, that the omnipresent should comfort him, right? Hamakom yinachem, this line that we're sort of instructed to say at the conclusion of a shiva call, but rather to give him encouragement to be comforted. Okay, and I think this language is actually very specific. Cheyitein lo chizuk lehitnachem, to give the mourner encouragement to be comforted. And lehit nachem can also be read as the kind of reflexive tense of to comfort oneself. Okay, so the Rav Moshe, even at the very beginning, is saying there's two components of making a shiva call that a lot of people think are important and are actually maybe not that important. The first is saying this formula. This formula is not a requirement that you say it exactly and someone says amen. Right? This is not a magic formula. And the goal is not to go there and recite the formula. Right? The goal is to be a comforting presence, right? Really, though, a catalyst for the mourner to be comforted, to comfort themselves. Rav Moshe is noting, right, that not only is this phrase itself not really doing that much work, but even the comforter themselves is actually just setting the stage for the mourner themselves to have their own process and to work through their grief. Because with the blessing alone, a person is not comforted and put at ease in his spirit, which is the core of the comforting that the Torah requires. So that's a very high bar for what comforting is. You have to truly comfort the person and put their spirit at ease. Rather, it is as we saw with the friends of Eov, the friends of Job, who came to him to comfort him, that they spoke with him a lot. And similarly, Elihu, who is later in the story, and the Holy Blessed One himself, until Job's spirit was quiet. I want us to notice there's a little bit of a tension here. On the one hand, Rav Moshe says, don't say the formulaic thing. That's not really what you're coming to do. You're coming to set the stage for the person to be comforted, to give them chizuk, to give them strength. But then he kind of veers off and he says, well, actually, you kind of want to talk a lot, just like Eov's friends did. They talked and talked and talked and talked. And finally, you know, you almost got the sense that they wore him down to the point where he was comforted. We're going to look a little bit more closely at the story of Iov and his so-called friends, as they say, with friends like Iov's, who needs enemies. But we are going to see, right, that when you actually look at what Iov's friends accomplished in a positive sense, it actually isn't, with all due respect to Rav Moshe, what Rav Moshe is describing here, right, that the more words that they provided, the better comforters they were. And I want to also look at another tshuva from Rav Sternbach, who's somewhat contemporaneous, who was presented with a different question. And it's kind of a similar question, right? The question that Rav Moshe is confronted with is, what about this phrase? Do I have to say this phrase? And the question that Rav Sternbach is faced with is, well, what about if I can't be there in person? Can I do nichum avelim? Can I comfort mourners through a letter? And he said, I was unsure, we're in the second source, if one can fulfill the mitzvah of comforting mourners with a letter. I heard a reliable testimony that our rabbi, the Brisker Rav, was certain that one could fulfill the mitzvah in this way, because comforting the mourners is not a law specific to speech. It's not actually about saying something. Because even if he came to console and didn't say a thing, since the mourner is comforted thereby, he fulfills his obligation. I want to say that one more time, because Rav Sternbach pushes this out as a kind of bidi avad. Oh, if he didn't succeed in saying the right thing, at least he was there and the mourner was comforted. Right? But we're going to see that actually being there and being silent might in some ways be the ideal. Okay, so we're going to change the emphasis a little. Right, because when he comes to console and doesn't say a thing, right, the mourner is comforted thereby, and he fulfills his obligation. The same rule applies to a letter. Since he is comforted thereby, he, that is the person who wants to visit the mourner, fulfills his obligation. That is what I heard. The basic question, can I use this technology of a letter to fulfill this mitzvah? The answer is yes, right, because it's not about reciting a formula. It's not really even about being in the room, it's about providing this kind of comfort. And then he says, in my humble opinion, it appears that there are two aspects regarding the comforting of mourners. One is the comforting of the mourners themselves. You want to make those people feel better, in the plain sense. And further, and here's the second element, it is a rectification and goodness for the dead when they come to visit. As Maimonides explains, right, the Rambam teaches that when somebody passes away and there are no relatives, there are no mourners to be comforted, we kind of create a mock situation where 10 people come and sit in his place, right, in the place where the person passed away, for 7 days, and the people gather. Right, so it's clear that there's something about comforting the mourners, which is not about the mourners, because even when there aren't mourners, there still is this ritual of comforting the dead. We just sort of have stand-ins. We sort of import these 10 people to kind of represent the spirit of this person. Therefore, it seems that condolences by letter are effective only to comfort the mourners. But the second aspect, which is a rectification for the dead, is not fulfilled with the letter. Okay, for those of you who are not interested in the kind of legal distinction of is it for the mourner, is it for the person who passed away, good. We're actually not focused on that either. What I want you to see is that even though Rav Sternbach is saying technically you can fulfill this obligation by using a letter, it is not ideal. Right? What actually is ideal is that you come to comfort in person. So only if he is unable to come to comfort in person, he should send a letter at the very least in order to comfort the mourners. But when he is able to come, that is a special tikkun, that is a special rectification. Only if it is impossible to come may he send a letter. And if the letter arrives during the Shiva, that's great. There is some comforting of the mourners in that, which holds a very great reward. Right, so what Sternbach is trying to do is really two things at once. The first thing he's trying to do is say, it's not about the ritual, right? It's about the result, and therefore, if the result is achieved through sending a letter, you can send a letter. But then he also says, but is comforting the mourners really achieved in its fullest sense when you send a letter? We know. Right, that there is a kind of hierarchy of communication. Certainly in our day, it's much more complex. And we know, right, the highest form of communication is I show up and we're face-to-face. Maybe that right after that is a video call. Underneath that is a phone call. Underneath that is an email. Underneath that is a text. Underneath that is a somebody writing Baruch Diana Met on somebody's Facebook wall. And we should learn, right, from this tshuva of Rav Sternbach that we want to be as high up on that ladder as possible. If we have a relationship with someone and our presence is going to matter, we have to do our utmost to be present. And so what I want to focus on now is move away from the words and focus more on the presence. And one of the reasons why I think it's so important for us not to focus on the words and the notion that the words are going to comfort the mourner is because, with all due respect to Rav Moshe's articulation of the ideal, I think it's impossible, and I think probably most of you agree, to actually say the right thing that is going to comfort that mourner, right? We have, on the one hand, this person's whole relationship with the deceased, all of their emotions, all of their memories, bad memories, good memories, this whole complex of their relationship with this other person, and you come in and you say, I'm sorry for your loss. That is going to at all compare with what that person is going through? Impossible. Okay, and we see this actually borne out in the Psukim. So we're on page 2, where we see Yaakov tore his clothes and he girded himself with sackcloth. And he mourned his son, right, that is Yosef, for a long time. All of his sons and daughters got up to comfort him, right? They saw that, I mean, Yaakov wasn't accurately mourning for a dead relative, but he thought he was, right? He thought that he was mourning for Yosef. And he refused to be comforted. And he said, I will go down to the underworld with my son. And his father cried over him, right? And this language of he refused to be comforted, right, I think is actually extremely important. What does Yaakov need in order to be comforted? What Yaakov needs in order to be comforted is for Yosef to come back. If Yosef is not going to come back, then Yaakov is going to refuse to be comforted. And it's not just Yaakov, right? It's anybody who's in the situation of being a mourner. What they want and what they need is to go back in time and to bring that person back to life. If you, with all due respect to your powers of persuasion and your powers of speech, are not able to do that for them, you have to understand that what you are able to do is inherently limited. You are not going to comfort them. And if I were to just, you know, say it plainly, really, your best bet is to not make things worse. And instead of coming with the, you know, with the ideal of I'm going to say the right thing and it's going to fix this person's problem, instead you want to recognize with humility that this person is experiencing a problem that cannot be fixed. And instead of trying to come with your mountain of words, right, and oppress them with all of your comfort, right, maybe the appropriate stance to take is one that is more humble and recognizes that unless you can bring this person back in time, your powers are extremely limited, right? And we see also in Yirmiyahu another situation where somebody refuses to be comforted. Here, Rachel, Yaakov's wife, but of course, this is a more mythical Rachel because we are way, way further on in Jewish history. God said, a voice is heard in Ramah, a wailing and bitter crying, Nihi Bechi Tamburim, Rachel Mevaka Albanaha. Rachel is crying over her children. Me'ana lehinachem, she refuses to be comforted. Okay, the same language we see with Yaakov, ki einanu, because her children are not there. Okay, so she takes the very logical and very normal approach where she says, no, I'm going to continue to cry until the situation is resolved. The only thing that is going to bring her comfort is if the situation is resolved. Okay, and we're going to see in the next source, also from the Yaakov, Yosef, Rachel complex of characters, where we do have a situation of comforting. But now do not be afraid. Now here's Yosef speaking to his brothers. I will sustain you and your children. And he comforted them and spoke to their hearts. Why is Yosef able to comfort his brothers, whereas his parents were not able to be comforted? Because Yosef is the vizier of Egypt, and Yosef has storehouses and storehouses and storehouses full of food, and he also has a heart full of forgiveness, and he's able to actually solve his brother's problems. He's able to feed them, and he's able to reconcile with them, and therefore, they are able to be comforted. So again, right, to state this, you know, in the most plain sense, we have this ideal that what we're doing is coming to comfort mourners, that we're somehow going to be making their situation better. And what I really want us to instead acknowledge is actually what we're trying to do is not make the situation worse. It is much worse to say the wrong thing than it is to not say the right thing in this kind of situation. What we want, right, is for a mourner to not feel at the time of their loss, they are alone. We don't want them to feel nobody cares about them. Okay, so we're coming to compensate for those feelings that we're able to compensate for. But we're not actually coming to do the work of comforting a person using our words. We're going to get a little bit into Eov and his so-called friends. Now, if you remember, Rav Moshe had this very sunny idea of Eov's friends and their capacity to comfort, because he knows that in the Talmud, Eov's friends are presented as the model of people that come to do nichum avilim, who come to comfort mourners. Eov lost children. Eov lost all of his stuff. Eov's in a bad place. You know, they don't call it the suffering of Job for nothing. And so we have, in the beginning, Eov's three friends heard about this evil that had befallen him, that had befallen Job, befallen Eov, and they each came from their place. And they gathered together to nod with him, lanud lo ulenachamo, and to comfort him. Okay, and this image of nodding, right, is actually extremely powerful. We're going to see it come up over and over again, that this is the kind of communication that is considered to be the comforting of mourners. You show up, you sit there, and you nod. Right? You participate to the extent that you are able to. You are kind of affirming the experience that they're having. They are having an experience, and you are nodding. Right, if you've ever read the book of Job, and most people haven't because it is extremely, extremely long, it is chapter after chapter after chapter of these so-called friends telling Eov that God never does anything without a good reason, and he must not be as great as he thinks he is. Now, even by our standards, right, of what might be considered comforting, it's pretty clear, okay, that even if you could comfort somebody with words, these are not the words you want to choose to comfort someone. And then we do see at the end, and God said these words to Eov, we're in the second box on page 3. God said to Eliphaz, I am incensed at you and your two friends, for you did not speak properly about me like my servant Eov. Right? God says explicitly, everything that you said, all of your accusations are simply out of place. Right? And all these chapters of your self-righteousness, which you were calling comforting, were actually completely, completely inappropriate. And then God returned the loss of Eov. Who's going to do the real comforting here? It's going to be God. And what is the real comforting? It's not God going to Eov and saying, there, there, Eov, so sorry for your loss. It's God actually coming and restoring to Eov what he lost. And God increased everything that Eov had by 2. And all of his brothers and sisters and everyone who knew him before, they entered and they ate bread in his house and they nodded with him. Again, that language of lanud. And they comforted him regarding all of the evil that God brought upon him. Okay, and so we see the people who are successful comforters are people who, A, are doing more nodding than they are doing talking, and B, are coming in at the point of the story where everything's turning around for Eov and he's actually able to be comforted. Whereas if these same people had come, you know, I don't know, in chapter 9, they would not have actually any success. And we see the Gemara picking up on the good quality of the type of comfort that Eov's friends provided, where Rabbi Yochanan said the comforters, right, the people who are coming to pay the Shiva call, are not permitted to say anything until the mourner initiates. As it says, Acharechein. Afterwards, Eov opens his mouth, right? After chapters and chapters and chapters of being berated, Eov finally responds. And only subsequently, Vayan Eliphaz Ateimani, then Eliphaz also speaks in turn. Okay, so we see that Rabbi Yochanan is using the model of Eov's friends, not in the way that Rav Moshe implied, where they just kept on talking at him until he felt better. But actually, to teach you that you're not supposed to be the initiator of the conversation. You're not supposed to be the one that comes and supplies the words. You are supposed to be a responder. And it's hard to imagine this, right? But there is an ideal, in some sense, shivi call, where you show up. The person is, you know, wrapped in their own thoughts. You sit there. They don't say, hi, how are you? They don't say, thank you for coming. They don't start talking about the memories that they have of their sister or child or whoever, God forbid, they lost. And then after a respectable amount of time, they nod, you nod, and you leave. We're not accustomed to thinking of that as the ideal. But in some ways, what we see from these sources is that is the ideal, right? You are taking your cue from the mourner. And if the mourner does not want to talk to you, you don't talk to them. And the Metsudat David really, even though he's not a legal text, but he is a great interpreter of the book of Job, of Eov, and he is going to be very explicit, right, about what we're going to learn from Eov's friends. Ish mimkamo, each of Eov's friends come from their own place. Each one came from his own place to the place of Eov. Right, so the first thing you're noticing here is they are traveling. Right, they're putting in the effort, they're coming to him. And when they were there, they gathered together to come to Eov's house to nod their heads, like one who shares in the distress of the one he loves, and also to comfort him with words of comfort. Okay, and you could see that Surat David is disentangling these two components of the visit. One is sharing in the distress, right? And instead of ignoring that something terrible happened to you, I'm showing up when something terrible happened to you. I'm stepping into it. I'm trying to be there with you to the extent that that's possible. And also they thought that they might say something comforting. Okay, but that's not actually the main objective. The main objective is to participate in the distress. And it seems that the way that you participate is this silent nodding of the head. And no one speaks. Ve'ein dover. No one of them said anything to Eov because they saw how great the pain was and they didn't have a strategy with which to comfort him. Okay, they came with a plan of nodding and talking. Then, because they actually were able to do the first component, they were able to tap into Eov's distress, they realized that they couldn't say anything. They decided not to say anything. And then achareichen, afterwards, ka'asher chalfu shivat hayamim, after the 7 days, the shiva, right, of shiva fame, the 7 days have passed. Okay, so they are actually spending the entirety of the shiva span in silence. And the only time they are willing, right, to start speaking is after that time has elapsed. Okay, they're sort of respectfully present with Eov until that time. So in case this isn't clear, right, just to summarize what we've seen, there's a kind of popular understanding of Eov's friends as coming to comfort him by speaking. And then we see when we look a little bit more closely through the interpretation of Rabbi Yochanan and through the interpretation of the Metsudat David, that what Eov's friends did well was be silent and participate in Eov's distress through nodding, and what they didn't do well was start talking. Fortunately, according to the Metsudat David, they waited a respectable amount of time before they started talking. And what we are associating them with, this, you know, torrent of words, is actually the least positive element of what they did. The most positive element of what they did was come from their place to be in Eov's place, both in a physical sense and in an emotional sense. They said, we are going to step into the difficulty. We're going to look you in the eye and look at the pain that's in your face. We're going to hand you the tissues when you are crying instead of looking uncomfortably away. I want to continue this thread of taking our cues from the mourner. Because everything that I said about silence is all hunky-dory and all appropriate if what the mourner wants is silence. Okay, but there are a lot of people who do, you know, sort of process what happened to them by either not processing, right, and wanting to talk about anything else, or by, you know, talking and wanting you to talk. Okay, so really the most important thing to learn from this is silence is your default, because silence is a posture of you waiting to see what the mourner wants. And so the Rambam is going to describe for us the kind of ideal situation. The mourner sits at the head, and the comforters may only sit on the ground. As it says, they sat with him on the earth. Okay, this is not how it usually is set up in our Shiva houses today. Usually the person who is sitting Shiva is on that kind of special low chair. And then everybody else who comes is also sitting, but they're sitting in like on the couch, on the nice chairs, right? So the Rambam is saying, well, actually, ideally, we'd all be on those little chairs. Everyone's going to be sitting low to the ground because we're supposed to be with you. We're supposed to be, to the extent that it's possible, participating in your sorrow. And they are not permitted to say a word until the mourner opens their mouth. As it says, no one said a word to him. And it's written afterwards, Eov opens his mouth and cursed his birth. We're not going to talk too much about Eov and his cursing. And then Eliphaz responded. And once the mourner has nodded his head, the comforters may not stay there any longer, so as not to trouble him too much. Okay, here's an extra element, right? Just as important as it is to show up, it's also very important to leave. And I want to just really harp a little bit more on this idea that what you're doing in the Shiva house primarily is coming and being silent, from a statement of Rabbi Zeira. And Rabbi Zeira has this long list of laudable things to do, what you're actually being rewarded for. And what he means by what you're actually being rewarded for is all of these laudable things have something about them that is uncomfortable. And actually what the schar, right, the reward is for being willing to put up with that discomfort. Okay, so for example, right, the reward for the lecture is for the running. Okay, so when you get points, right, for attending this lecture, it's not for the actual learning that you've done. It's the inconvenience of having to turn on your computer. Okay, he's imagining that going to lectures requires a little bit more travel. Okay, and the reward for the Torah conference, right, the kala, the big gathering of all the Torah scholars, is duchka, being squished, right? So you're not actually getting reward for the Torah that you're learning. You're getting reward for being stuck like a sardine in this uncomfortable conference hall. Okay, there's a longer list, and we are interested in what Rav Papa says. Rav Papa says the reward for the house of mourning is for the silence, right? That's not only the most important part, but it's actually the most difficult part, right? What you are getting rewarded for when you go to comfort a mourner is not comforting them. What you are getting reward for is your own discomfort, is your being willing to sacrifice your own need, right, to fix things, your own need to avoid things that are unpleasant. When you are overcoming that and you're just there and you're sitting in the silence and you're willing to step into that silence, that uncomfortable silence, that's actually where the reward lies. And the last source that we're going to look at before we take a few questions is a source from the Aruch HaShulchan, who's a 19th century, I think, halachic work. They say there further, that is in Moed Katan, that once the mourner nods his head, it is not permitted to sit with it. Okay, this is where the Rambam got that idea that you are not allowed to stay once you've been dismissed. And nodding his head is, as is understood, that it appears that he is dismissing the comforters, wants them to leave, and therefore it is inappropriate for them to continue sitting there. For it's not polite to say explicitly that they should go, right? When you're at a Shabbat meal and it's time for everybody to go, the host doesn't usually say, "You'll be leaving now." Usually the host says, "Why don't we bench so nobody feels like they need to stay longer than they want to?" Right, and really what they mean by that is, I'm tired and I would like to go to bed. Right, it's not explicitly, you don't want to say, it's 9 o'clock, you really should leave. So the sign was that he would nod his head. There was this kind of social convention. I would nod, and everybody would be like, oh, that's the nod. And they would all disperse. And the Rambam wrote the reason that they shouldn't overly inconvenience him. For us, this sign is not well known. Right, when the time the Aruch HaShulchan is writing, it's not actually, right, the convention for mourners to nod. And therefore, the comforters need to be sensitive to the mourner when he wants them to leave him and they should depart. Right, and so I just want to close this section, right, with really underscoring that what it means to take your cue from the mourner does not just mean showing up. It also means leaving, right? And our desire, right, is to come and to talk and to fix something by speaking. But that's actually our desire, right? We want to fix. But what we should be doing is taking our cue from the mourner. Does the mourner want our presence? Or does the mourner want us to go? Does the mourner want our conversation? Or does the mourner want to sit in silence? Right? What we're learning mostly, right, from this image of silence and from this image of nodding, right, is that nodding is the invitation, nodding is the participation, and nodding is the dismissal, right? And that in each of these stages, we are always taking our cue from the mourner and trying to really almost copy, mirror what the mourner is doing, because we're trying to participate in their sorrow. We're trying to be there with them.
Jumping off of that last point about taking cues from the mourners, we have some folks who are curious about mourners who may be influenced by maybe the accepted customs of the Shiva, and instead of maybe allowing themselves to feel what they're feeling and cueing people and this and that, they actually feel almost as if they have to host you and talk to you and, you know, and things like that. So it's almost this twisted situation where now because of the customs, they are expected to do certain things and you're responding to them in that kind of way. So we were just hoping you could speak to that, you know, to the way that this has developed. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's an extremely important question. The culture of, you know, putting out a spread, right, for the people that are coming to pay a Shiva call is very strong and really, truly bizarre, a little bit backwards, because the idea is that you're supposed to be providing food for the mourner, and then there's food there, and the mourner's like, this is too much food, you guys should eat. And then eventually kind of devolved into there would be like a hosting situation where the mourner is hosting. So I would say, you know, just culture is culture, and it is very, very hard to push back on. I think that's one of the things that we learn from the Aruch HaShulchan, right, that there are certain social conventions that people can't escape. But I think also what he's teaching is don't just look for the social convention, right? Look for what's happening underneath. And I think sometimes, you know, we can sense, even though somebody says, you know, oh, please stay, please eat something, that actually they're looking at their watch, actually they look kind of tired, right? And there are ways to kind of read a person through the mask of social convention and what they are saying because they think it's what they want us to hear. But also I would say, you know, to the extent that it is like culturally expected to, you know, say this bracha of HaMakom Yenachem, or, you know, to spend a certain amount of time, you know, if a mourner is expecting that and they don't receive it, right, that can also be perceived as a slight. And it's very difficult, right, but really the lesson is to read the room. Sometimes, you know, the room is not going to look like, you know, the perfect kind of halachic ideal, but really the halachic ideal is there to show you, right, if you are talking, you're not listening, right, and listening comes in a lot of forms. It also comes in kind of looking around, being sensitive. And the last thing that I would say is, you know, generally people are fortunate enough to have family who are there when they're sitting Shiva. It's not usually just the mourners themselves. You can ask a child of, you know, the person who's mourning or a close friend who's there a lot, like, does, you know, Bob really want me to stay, or would it be better for him if I left, right? That don't necessarily have to put all of the burden of communication of the need on the mourner themselves, because they might not be in a position where they feel comfortable communicating that need, but our antennae need to be up where we're trying to figure out what the need actually is, which may totally conform with social convention and may not. But it's a very astute question, and it's very hard to really figure out what to do.
I'm reading. It almost seems that the purpose of the Shiva today is to enable the mourner to talk about the deceased and teach the visitor things about them. Is this an entirely modern convention, since it doesn't seem to be mentioned in these sources? Or is there something else at play? And somebody else mentioned that when they were sitting Shiva, hearing stories about the deceased was one of the most impactful pieces of it for them. So yeah, I think I've been getting at that dynamic between talking too much, silence. Yeah.
Yeah. So certainly if you are going to be speaking at a Shiva, and I assume that in most Shivas that you go to, right, you are going to be speaking generally. I don't think that this class is going to turn the tide to just being quiet. First of all, that's not realistic. And second of all, that's not what most mourners want. Right? Most mourners do want this kind of interaction. But I think that sort of what this question is pointing to is those kinds of conversations, which were actually about the deceased and about the mourner's relationship with the deceased, were an incredible opportunity, right, for that person to have some time to think about and talk about the person who they lost, to hear stories about the person that they lost. That's great, right? That is in some sense the ideal if that's what the mourner wants. But I think that we've all witnessed, right, somebody comes in and they're just talking about the weather, they're talking about, you know, whatever is happening, just because they want to fill the silence with speaking, right? And that's what I'm concerned about. I'm not concerned about, you know, topical and, you know, valuable conversation around the person who has passed. I'm concerned about the fear, right, of stepping into what's difficult, of talking about the person. And I just want to say, like, one more thing, which we're also going to go through at the end. For those of you who scrolled forward in the source sheet, you'll see I have like a page of just guidelines. Not that I'm an expert, but just it's helpful to always have something that's concrete and written down, where I mention that you don't always want to ask the person about the circumstances of the passing of their loved one, right? And this is like a very, very standard question to ask, which is like, oh, how did they pass? Oh, were they sick? Oh, what did they have? Oh, who was their doctor? And for some people, they want to talk about this, right? It's actually cathartic for them to like rehearse it and to be able to say, you know, they passed in their sleep, they lived a long life. But for a lot of people, it's invasive, right? It's inappropriate. And it's just one of those things that like sometimes when it happens at the will of the mourner, it is great. And when it doesn't happen at the will of the mourner, it's totally gross, right? Somebody just lost their dad and you want to talk to them about his final heart surgery? It's like, it's not appropriate. And so again, like it's not easy to know always like which path you want to choose, but it's just really important to whatever extent it's possible to be listening to the mourner and taking your cues from them.
So a question here is, we seem to see that there's a tension here with regard to comforters, where some of our customs seem to want to differentiate the mourners from the rest of the conversation, from the rest of the congregation, sitting on lower chairs, reciting mourners' Kaddish separately. And over here, we seem to have many texts about how comforters should support mourners by sitting along with them. So can you talk a little bit about the dynamic of distinguishing mourners and caring for them, as opposed to joining with them as a way of caring with them, caring for them?
Great. Yeah, I'll talk about it briefly. I think there's a distinction between, you know, participating in someone's grief and sort of being there either metaphorically or actually on the floor with them and confusing yourself with them, right? And I think that to the extent that we sort of want to name, this is the person who is in grief, this is the person that we are focusing on. And sometimes it's helpful, right, to have that person be in the low chair. It's helpful to have that person, you know, coming in a particular point in Kabbalat Shabbat and everybody realizes, oh, you know, I didn't get the shul email, but now I see that so-and-so is in Avelut, so-and-so is mourning, right? And there's a lot of significance to having those signals, right? I think that we want to, on the mourner side, we don't want them to be in a position where too much attention is being called to them and they're kind of like embarrassed and it's enough. And also from the comforter side, right, there's an element of participating in someone's sorrow, which is comforting, and you feel like, you know, you're being present with them. And then there's also a crossing of the line that is dangerous and can happen where you are so, so upset about this person's loss that you're there crying, right? You're the one with mascara running down your face. You're the one who's a mess. And actually, like, if you are also having like a strong emotional reaction to this loss, that should be happening elsewhere. It should not be happening in the presence of the mourner, because you want to be participating in their pain. You don't want to be necessarily, you know, exhibiting the same kind of pain as they are, if that distinction is useful. Obviously, in this kind of topic, the questions are always going to be better than the answers. Really, the goal here is to get ourselves to be thinking about those questions and to be listening for the possible, you know, cues that there are to, you know, resolving some of these issues. I want to move a little bit away from the abstract to the concrete. We're going to move to a Gemara in Sota, which talks about, you know, the very important principle of walking after God, right? We're supposed to sort of follow God, which can be understood as being very literal, right? You're supposed to walk after God. Okay, so Rabbi Hanina said, what is the meaning of the verses writing, Acharei Adonai Eloheichem Teilechu, walk after Hashem your God? Is it possible for a human to walk after the divine presence, right? So we're reading this verse hyper-literally, right, to ask this question, could you do that? Didn't it say God is a burning fire, right? Adonai Elohecha Esh Ochlahu. It's a little bit dangerous, right? Do you really want to get that close? You want to be walking right after God? Bad idea. So rather, surprise, surprise, it's going to be metaphorical. Follow in God's ways. Just as the Holy One, the Holy Blessed One, clothes the naked, Malbish Arumim, as we know that after eating from the tree of knowledge, Adam and Chava realized that they were naked, they were embarrassed, and so God made them clothes, God made them tunics. So too, you should clothe the naked. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy Blessed One, visited the sick, as we know that Hashem appeared to Avraham in Elonei Mamre. So too, right after Avraham's Brit Milah, so too, you should visit the sick. The Holy Blessed One comforted mourners, as it is written, after the death of Avraham, God blessed his son Yitzchak. Okay, it's a very interesting proof text for God comforting mourners, this image of God blessing Yitzchak. So too, you should comfort mourners. The Holy Blessed One buried the dead, as it is written, he buried Moshe in a ravine. So too, you should bury the dead. Okay, now what I want you to notice is in this list, right, one of these things looks like it might not be like the others. We have clothing the naked, very concrete. You take the clothes, you give them to the person, they put them on, right? We have visiting the sick, which we are going to see through the Rambam is also, right, a kind of physical thing that you do, where you're taking care of the needs of the sick. And we have burying the dead, right? That is, of all of these activities, probably the most physical, right? You're in there in the dirt and you're using your body to bury the dead. And then in this list is comforting the mourners. Okay, and so what I want to do in this next section is use these images, right? Use this list of these kinds of kindnesses to give us a new entry point into thinking about what we're trying to do when we are comforting the mourners. Okay, so we're going to look at the Rambam. And the Rambam is going to list all of these. It is a positive rabbinic mitzvah, mitzvat aseh, to visit the sick, comfort mourners, bring out the dead, welcome the bride, accompany guests, engage in all the elements of burial, be a pallbearer, walk at the funeral procession, eulogize, dig, bury. And similarly, on the other end of the spectrum, to gladden the groom and bride. And here's the part that I want you to focus on. Ulisa'adam bechol tzorcheihem, to support all of their needs. These are acts of kindness that one does bigufo, with their own body. She'ein lahem shiur, and there is no prescribed amount. Okay, the Rambam does not think when he's listing out these mitzvot that, oh, there's something sort of psychological in comforting the mourners, but everything else is physical and bodily. No, comforting the mourners is part and parcel of this list. And what you are trying to do when you are doing nichum avilim is l'sa'adam bechol tzorcheihem, to support all of their needs. Okay, and so what I want to argue is our model for what we should be doing in Nichum Avilim, of comforting mourners, should be analogous to what we do when we visit the sick, Bikur Cholim. Bikur Cholim also, right, runs the risk of being thought of as, you should not, you say things and then you leave, okay? But when you look at the Shulchan Aruch, which is the last source on page 5, we're going to see very concretely that what Bikur Cholim is about is taking care of the needs of the sick and also being sensitive to the emotional, right, elements of what it might mean to have somebody enter your sick room, right, have somebody invade your space when you're in a place of vulnerability, right? And so he says, we do not visit people who are chole me'ayim, who have intestinal illnesses, right? These are people that are running to the bathroom every 5 minutes. They may not smell good and they might be embarrassed about their smell, right? Or people who have an eye infection or people who have headaches, right? If somebody has a migraine, you don't want to come in with your simcha machine and, you know, make a lot of noise because you're trying to gladden somebody who's sick, right? The right way to support someone who has a headache is to turn off the lights, close the door, and leave. Okay, so the Shulchan Aruch is saying, when we think of visiting the sick, we think of stepping into their room. But there are certain people for whom the proper way to visit them is to not visit them, right? Because they're embarrassed in their condition, or your presence is actually going to make them more uncomfortable. And similarly, anyone who is generally overcome and speaking is hard for them, we do not visit face to face. Okay, and there are some people for whom it's just too much. Right, I think this goes back to the question that was asked earlier about, you know, there's some element sometimes of hosting a Shiva house, right? You don't want to have that situation in the Shiva house, but you certainly don't want to have that situation when somebody's ill, where they feel like, oh, they got to schlep themselves out of bed to make you tea, right? Where they feel like your presence is in some way a burden on them. Rather, we enter into an external space and we ask and inquire about them, if they need someone to clean the floors or the like. And we listen to their pain and pray on their behalf. I'm gonna read that one more time. Right, shoalim v'dorshim bo. We ask and inquire, right? This is actually a language that's very Torah-esque, right? The notion of doresh, right? We're gonna be seeking the information that may not be clearly apparent on the surface. And we inquire about them. Okay, this is also should remind you of what I said about, you know, you could ask a relative, right? You could ask somebody else who's in the environment. You don't need to put all of the burden of communication on the mourner themselves. And we ask, does someone need to clean the floors? That's the best Bikur Cholim. And I have to say, you know, when I gave birth the first time and my mother came, I had a C-section, so I was definitely in the category of a chola. And the number one thing that I remember she did for me was sweep the floors. It just made me, I mean, I don't think she was basing herself on this Shulchan Aruch, which is based on Rabbi Akiva and his students, right? But it was just like, she was the force of keeping things together. And I never asked her once to sweep the floor. And I didn't even know, right, that that's what I needed. But the fact that she swept the floor every day was huge. It made me feel like everything's okay. I'm being taken care of. My house is not falling apart. And so when we have Bikur Cholim as the model, right, we see that there is this element of shomin sa'aro, listening to a person's sorrow, and davening on their behalf, all of these more abstract, more verbal things, right? But the core of Bikur Cholim is to address the need of the person who is ill, right? And we think of it as, I'm going to go visit. I'm going to pay a shiva call. I'm going to visit the sick. Right, but actually, the most significant thing that you can do is address the needs. And we're going to talk about this, you know, on my little cheat sheet of how to be a good comforter, right? But, you know, maybe the best way to comfort the mourner is to do their grocery shopping, not to necessarily have a conversation with them about something that's difficult. Okay, great. So let's get to this amazing list of guidelines, which of course is not an exhaustive list of guidelines and also definitely carries with it the caveat of every situation is different. But I think often when we're in, you know, difficult situations where things feel touchy or things feel complex, we often just sort of throw our hands up and say, oh, it's so complex. Oh, it's so difficult. And it can be helpful to have a kind of checklist, to have certain very concrete guidelines to appeal to make the abstract difficulty much more concrete and much more manageable. So the first is a kind of axiom. There's a, as far as I'm concerned, and people can disagree with me, I'm certainly not in a position to argue with Rav Moshe, but in my opinion, there is a fundamental misalignment between what the halacha expects, right, or the language, which is successfully comforting the mourner, and what we are actually capable of achieving. And so this whole lecture, right, has been about shifting ourselves from trying to successfully comfort the mourner to doing what we are actually capable of achieving. It is very difficult, the next axiom, it is very difficult to say the right thing and very easy to say the wrong thing. Okay, and so we would, instead of trying, right, to say the right thing, our goal should be not to say the wrong thing. And it may be that the only way that we're not going to say the wrong thing is to not say anything at all. That's okay. As you may have learned, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. That is a principle that not only applies in a kindergarten classroom, it applies to everywhere in our adult lives. We don't always have to fill the space with talking. We don't have to fumble around to say the right thing. If we're not sure what the right thing is to say, which is totally legitimate, right, we don't have to say anything at all. Everyone experiences grief differently, so it's hard to craft a unified approach. You don't want to have your 3x5 card with the questions you always ask at a shiva, because everybody's different, and you really need to be reading the room, you really need to be sensitively responding to people. Here's another important axiom which we didn't discuss explicitly. Not everyone has a strong or positive relationship with the person they are sitting shiva for, or sometimes we don't get to sit shiva for the people who are closest to us. You know, we lose grandparents and we're not part of the collection of shiva sitters, and that can be very hard for people. And also sometimes people have, you know, very terrible relationships with their quote-unquote loved ones, you know, and they're doing what the halacha demands. They want to do right by their parent, their sibling, whatever, they're sitting shiva. But that doesn't mean, right, that they have a positive relationship with the deceased. And we really have to be careful in saying anything that might imply that we know, right, the nature of that person's relationship. Next axiom, even though it's hard, you still have to go. Right? That's what we learned from Rav Sternbach. There's this kind of hierarchy of communication. If you are at all possible able to show up in person, you gotta show up in person. That's the best way to do it. You gotta go. And so now we're gonna move into some more concrete guidelines as far as what to do. Don't come at a time that is convenient for you. Come at a time that is convenient for the mourner. So, in case that's not obvious, here are some examples. You don't want to come at meal times. You don't want to come very late at night or very early in the morning. Often people will provide a calendar. I'm available between 5 and 8. So only come during that time and do not come later than a half hour before the end of any visiting window. Okay, there's halachic terminology, ad v'lo'ad bechlal, right? When somebody gives you an hour, do you assume that it's the end, includes that hour itself? When you're talking about shiva calls, you should assume when someone says, I am available from 5 to 9, they want you out of their house by 9. Not, you come in at 8:59 and you can stay as late as you want and party till midnight. Take your cues for conversation from the mourner. If it's possible, wait for them to speak first. Some awkward silence is okay. You are there to be present and to listen, not to speak. If you have to ask questions, and sometimes you do feel like you have to, try to ask neutral questions, such as, do you have any strong memories of person X that are coming to you right now? Strong can be positive or negative, right? That's neutral terminology. Are there any memories that are coming up for you right now? Can you tell me something about that person that I might not know? Right, and that enables the person to say whatever they want to. about the deceased. Were there any interesting people from your past who came to the funeral or the Shiva? We make it about the event, not about the person. Did you learn anything new about that person that you didn't know before? And this also reflects that question that we had earlier, right, about for some people, this is the highlight of the Shiva, where they get to learn things about the deceased that they didn't know before. And it's great to provide an opportunity for them to, you know, share that information forward. And here is maybe the most important and most difficult piece, and this is where I am going to get into wordsmithing of how you should speak or not speak. Try not to make declarative statements about the deceased that are not based on your own personal experience. Here are some examples. Don't say, "I can tell that he was a great father," because you don't know whether that person was a great father. What you can say is whatever it is from your personal experience that made you think that that declarative statement was okay. So you could say, "When we were children, your father was very kind to me." That's true. That's personal. That is something that somebody might want to hear about their father. Don't say, "Your mother was such a kind woman." Say, "I appreciated that your mother ran the shul clothing drive. Here is where I saw her manifesting kindness. I, you know, valued that. I, you know, really respected that. And I want to share that memory." But not, "I know this thing about your mother, that she had this quality." Because you don't really know that that was that person's experience of her. Unless it is clear that the mourner finds solace in this, do not ask probing questions about the circumstances of the death. Now, it is true, I've seen it many times, that people do love to rehash those details. And if that's something the mourner wants to do, great. But if that's not something that it's clear that the mourner wants to do, it's really invasive and really inappropriate, even though it's extremely common, to ask them about the circumstances of the death. Unless it is clear that the mourner will find solace in this, do not trot out theological platitudes. Don't go in there and say, "I'm sure that this person is in a better place." Are you sure that that person is in a better place? Do you know what happens in the afterlife? Now, there are certain people who are going to find these statements comforting, but there are a lot of people who will not find these statements comforting. So unless you know for sure that this is someone who wants to, needs to hear your, you know, loved one is in a better place, don't say it. You are not there to be the theological authority on life and death. You are there to be present for the mourner. Try to be helpful in specific bodily ways. Okay, this was the last thing that we discussed with the model of visiting the sick. Show up to Minyan as many times as you can. Right? If they're having a Shiva Minyan, show up for it. Right? And this does not have to be also bound together with a Shiva call. You could just come for the Minyan and leave. Right, but that is a huge relief for the mourner to know that there's a reliable group of people praying with them in the event that that's something that they're doing. And ask, can you pick up their kids at school? Are they out of milk? Right, very concrete ways that you are available and ready to help. Right, do not, and here's the next piece, better to offer a specific service than to offer general help. It's very nice to say, "Anything you want, just call me." This person is not going to call you. Much better to say, "Hey, I'm on my way to ShopRite. Do you have a shopping list? I would be happy to pick up a few things for you. It's really no big deal for me to do it." You can lie. And we'll talk about lying in session number 3. You may not have a plan to go to ShopRite, right? But I give you official permission that if you think it's possible that the mourner needs groceries, you can make it seem like less of an inconvenience for you so that they're more likely to take you up on the offer for help. Also, it's better to ask around the mourner about their needs rather than troubling the mourner themselves. Right? People feel embarrassed, right, to say, "Oh, actually, I really need this. Oh, could you do this for me?" We like to feel self-sufficient, particularly when we're in a place of vulnerability. Right? Sometimes it actually feels very necessary, right, to assert that, like, we can handle it. And so maybe the mourner themselves is not going to say what their needs are. So if there are people around that you can ask, you should ask them. And as a side point, I didn't put this on the official list, but often the people who are supporting the mourners can also use support, right? So being able to say to them, I know that you're taking care of making sure that your father is eating enough. Why don't I do that for you for today? And that's two for one, right? Not only are you supporting the mourner by providing them with food, you're also taking something off the plate of the people who are supporting that mourner. Okay, we have two more main bullet points before we open it up for questions again. You can say comforting things and be there for them also after the Shiva. If you can't pay a Shiva call during Shiva, you may be able to find a way to do so after, right? I think we have this sense of like, oh, there's a window, there's a 6-day window where, you know, if I'm able to come, great. And if I'm not able to come, what was I supposed to do? Shiva was over. Well, I have bad news for you and good news for you. The bad news for you is that after Shiva, life doesn't automatically just go back to normal and people forget about all of their pain and grief. That's the bad news. But the good news is that means that your ability to comfort mourners by being present for them and supporting them extends for the extent of their grief, which could be forever. Okay, so there is a kind of tendency to say, like, it's a mitzvah to go during Shiva. I'm going to do my best to go during the Shiva. If I can't go during the Shiva, I've missed my opportunity. I am warmly encouraging you to not think in that way, and to really take your cues not from this sort of standard calendar, but from the mourner themselves. The last is that if you can go in person, you should go. You know, part of the reason why we're having this conversation and this series of lectures now is that, you know, we're moving towards a place where it is more expected, right, for us to start doing things in person again. And, you know, there may have been a 2-year span where there was no expectation where you would go to a Shiva house in person. But I think that expectation is coming back, and our muscles may be a little bit weak, a little bit atrophied, as far as actually getting in our car and driving somewhere far in order to be there with someone in person. But I think we all know, right, from our experience over the past couple of years, that in person cannot be replaced. And if you're able to go there in person, you should go.
We often see that there's a very big difference between when someone who is a public figure passes away, and the whole Shiva process is just a kind of a different order, both because of how many people are coming, but also because, and this is kind of this is leading into the question, because there's something like the visitors need to mourn to some extent. They're mourning the loss of this public figure and their relationship to them. And so we're wondering if you have any thoughts about that distinction between, you know, the death of a private person versus a public person, and maybe how do you navigate that when you're going to the mourner who actually lost someone immediately?
Great. Yeah, I think it's I think there's a few elements there that this question is bringing up, right? One is that every public person is also a private person, right? And so even if you are coming or, you know, interacting with that loss as if the person who was lost is a, you know, public figure, the mourner themselves is probably not a public figure. And also the person who passed is also not really a public figure. They're a public figure to you. They're not a public figure to themselves. All that aside, right, if we remember the second source that we saw with Rav Sternbach, where he talks about there's sort of two elements there. There's the element that's for the mourner, and there's the element for the person who passed, and that there's like a lot of honor being shown to that person. There's a tikkun for that person when a lot of people show up, right? That element might actually be to the disadvantage of the mourner, right? The mourner may not want hordes of people descending on their house, but out of honor for the person who passed, you know, we do want to, you know, show some sense of like, we honor this person's life and this person had an impact on us. As far as concrete guidance, here is what I would say. I think that it's probably best to maybe default to attending the funeral over defaulting to attending the Shiva when you're talking about someone who is a major figure, right? Because you want to show the honor of so many people, you know, were there for the funeral. The funeral is really about the person who passed away, listening to the eulogies, right? Being part of the big display. And maybe that's the better way for you to sort of participate as a tangential for lack of a better word, person in that in the deceased's life, rather than the Shiva, which really, you know, should be focused as much as possible on the needs of the mourner. And the second element, I think, goes to what I said about there's Shiva and there's beyond. And, you know, to the extent that you want to, reach out to that person and tell them, you know, how much of an impact, you know, their mother had on you through her books, right? Maybe write them a note, and that note comes after the Shiva, right? The default of I'm going to come and be present for you in person, I think really is when that is mourner focused and your presence is actually somewhat significant to them. But I, you know, very fortunate to not have had this experience, but I know that in Israel, right, there's a kind of common convention that when like somebody loses, you know, somebody in their family in, you know, an act of war, an act of terror, there's like a tendency where people kind of swarm and descend on the house. And I, you know, haven't spoken to any of these people personally, but there are, you know, often reports that the people who, you know, lost someone do find that actually very meaningful. And then there are also people who like specifically ask the news not to publicize their name and address because they don't want, you know, that kind of public attention. And this isn't an answer. This is just, you know, just another manifestation of that we really can't know what the mourner wants unless we know what the mourner wants. You know, and there are some people for whom, you know, it feels very meaningful. Like my son is now like a national hero and everybody's coming, you know, to pay a Shiva call and honor him. That could be very meaningful. And then there could be a lot of people who are like, I lost my son. You don't know him. You don't know me. What are you doing at my house? Who would find the hordes of people, you know, to be really, really distracting and really difficult to deal with. And unfortunately, we don't know until we know. So that's a very good question.
How would you approach the situation differently if you knew that the mourner had a difficult relationship with the person who passed away? When you know that, you know, that comforting just looks very different for that person.
I mean, obviously there's no perfect solution to this kind of situation. I think the first, you know, we really always want to be aware of the fact that it is quite possible that this situation is happening without our knowledge, right? And that's why it's so important to not make declarative statements about how great that person's relationship was with their father or how great their father was, because you really don't know what's going on for them inside. But what about the case, right, where you do know, and you do know that it was bad? I would say, first of all, it's just as important, if not more important, to show up, because that person might not only be dealing with feelings of grief, but also tremendous feelings of guilt, and just being able to kind of validate that person's experience and be there for them is very complex, usually for people who have difficult relationships with the deceased. I'll just tell you an anecdote. I had a friend who I happened to know that his mother was, I wouldn't say abusive, but close. And, you know, he, out of, you know, respect for her, did the whole Shiva, did everything. And what I did was I sat there, and every time somebody said something about, like, how great his mother was, I would, like, make eye contact with him, and I would, like, make a face, right? So that he would just have someone who was there who was, like, validating that, like, some of this is a little bit of a farce, and there's somebody here who knows, like, what you're actually feeling. So to the extent that you can, you know, be in a position like that, you know, at least for this friend, he really appreciated my ability to make a little bit of light of the situation. It's a good time to default to silence when you think that there's that kind of relationship that could possibly be there.